You'll have to double check me on this, but I'm pretty sure we don't say the words trade or tariff on the program today at all. And you are welcome. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, August the 9th. Glad as always to have you here, everybody. We do a decent amount, not a lot, but a decent amount of M&A on this program, mergers and acquisitions. And we'll start there today, but then go at it a little bit off center. We learned this morning the billion-dollar Sinclair Broadcast Group and Tribune Media merger is off, acrimoniously so, in fact. So, too, is the Albertsons-Rite Aid deal, a bit less acrimoniously, to be sure. The deals that get done get most of the press. We know that. So we asked Marketplace's Sabri Benishore to explain just how often mergers like this, both big and small, don't work out and why.
Like relationships, mergers and acquisitions fail. In fact, they fail a lot.
Once an acquisition is announced, roughly about 20% of the deals fail to complete.
David King is an associate professor at Florida State. So one out of five mergers and acquisitions just totally falls apart before the deal is sealed. But even after two companies put a ring on it, you often get misery, or at least low shareholder value.
And then after completion, roughly half the deals create value and half fail to create value.
Now, one thing to consider here is that things could have been even worse if they didn't get merged or acquired. A company could instead have spent money on research and development, for example. But you know what? That fails too.
About 70% of the funds spent on research development fail to go to commercially viable products.
So buying a ready-made company with a 50% success rate is actually an improvement. But why do mergers and acquisitions get called off or fail to create a lot of value so often? Well, sometimes the government says no, which is part of what happened with Sinclair. But also, companies are made of people, and people are messy.
One factor that is often underestimated in these cases is the cultural factor.
Matteo Tonello is with the conference board.
Culturally speaking, the mergers organizations really are not that compatible.
Sometimes companies only learn about problems after the merger. And sometimes managers' dreams of how great being merged will be for business just don't match up with reality. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Republican Congressman Chris Collins has pleaded not guilty to charges of securities fraud and lying to the FBI. Allegations are that he improperly passed on to family members information that he got as an investor in and a board member of a publicly traded Australian pharmaceutical company. So there's that. But there is also this. Sitting members of Congress trading stocks and sitting on corporate boards? Marketplace's Amy Scott has more on congressional investing do's and don'ts.
It's illegal for top government officials to trade stocks in industries they regulate or could influence, at least in the executive branch. But in Congress?
There are essentially no rules about stock trading activity for members of Congress, other than the fact that insider trading is now illegal.
And Craig Holman, government affairs lobbyist for Public Citizen, says that's only recently.
It's unbelievable. But prior to 2012, the law against insider trading that applies to you and I and Martha Stewart did not apply to members of Congress.
Then Holman says a 60 Minutes investigation embarrassed Congress into passing the STOCK Act, which stands for Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge. Lawmakers can still actively trade stock, even in companies overseen by their committees or affected by legislation before Congress. Law professor Donna Nagy at Indiana University says the thinking behind that
is that disclosure coupled with the electoral check from one's constituents is adequate protection.
Nagy doesn't buy that line of thinking. She says members of Congress should be banned from owning stock in or serving on the boards of publicly traded companies. Rules too stringent might discourage people from running for office, cautions Sheila Krumholz with the Center for Responsive Politics.
We don't want to make it so punitive that members of Congress are unable to invest, like most Americans.
Some research has shown those investments tend to outperform the overall market, suggesting that lawmakers are great stock pickers, or maybe they know something you and I don't. But any change in the law would have to come from Congress itself. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
A quick shout out before we go on, a double shout out, really. First of all, to the podcast that Molly Wood and I do every week. It's called Make Me Smart. It's culture, technology, and this economy. Second shout out of all to our latest episode, me talking to Leon Neyfakh about season 2, episode 1 of his podcast from Slate. It's called Slow Burn. Maybe you heard the first season about Watergate. S2 of Slow Burn is the Clinton impeachment. And I'll tell you what, episode 1 is pretty good. All right, on Wall Street today, well, look, Tesla was down 5%. Everything else, pretty much a snoozer. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Most of the immigration news since Election Day, since before then, really, has been about what was going to happen, what is happening, or what is being promised will happen along the border. The wall, kids being separated from their families, zero tolerance, all of it. And in fact, this week, the Trump administration reported the number of migrants arrested along the southwest border did drop June to July. Left unsaid was that that decline is in line with seasonal variations from years past. Summertime is a really bad time to be walking across the Sonoran Desert. Also left unsaid, though, in almost all of the current immigration debate going on in this country is that there are millions of undocumented immigrants already here, living and working in the really manual labor-intensive parts of this economy, agriculture and food processing, to name just two. A lot of those people are day laborers, going from one temporary job to the next. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, the Trump administration's crackdown is changing how they get by.
It's the annual Fiesta Mexicana in Woodburn, a small city in Oregon's Willamette Valley. Families gather at a local park for music and dancing, food, carnival rides. Ramon Ramirez is policy director at Picun, a local farm worker advocacy group.
Woodburn is like the cultural hub for farm workers in the Willamette Valley.
A freight rail line runs through the center of town. On the outskirts, fields of corn, vegetables, and grass seed. Back in February 2017, just after President Trump took office, ICE stopped two buses carrying laborers to the fields. According to local news reports at the time, 11 undocumented workers were detained.
When the raid came down, it sent shockwaves in the community. A lot of fear as I go out to the fields. And when I see people working, they're always looking over their shoulders. And, you know, this has created a big economic problem for supply of workers. People are actually fearing going to work.
Still, Ramirez says farm laborers, documented and undocumented, are showing up for seasonal work. Another way many undocumented immigrants find work is at day labor centers, where contractors come looking to hire people for cash, no questions asked. Places like the Don Bosco Worker Center in Port Chester, New York. It's located in a church in this town 30 miles north of New York City. Gonzalo Cruz, who was once a day laborer himself, runs the center. He says on a typical morning, 25 to 30 mostly undocumented men wait to be hired. The going rate is $120 a day. He says more have been showing up here since the Trump administration's immigration crackdown.
Now the workers, they feel more safety because we are the church. All of the churches is a sanctuary.
Cruz says these days more workers tell him that employers are refusing to pay.
They start talking like, oh, you don't have documents. Oh, I don't want to pay you. You are immigrant. Now I can call the immigration.
Marcos Martinez runs a day labor center in Seattle and is also hearing that wage theft is on the rise. Still, with the local economy booming, he hasn't seen a drop in people showing up to find work or employers seeking day laborers.
There's still the need for people to earn money to support themselves and their families. And people who are undocumented in this country have always had to operate, so to speak, in the shadows.
The economic impact of the Trump administration's immigration enforcement is hard to nail down. Here's what we do know, says Mark Hugo Lopez at the Pew Research Center.
It's largely a male population that's of prime working age. And so you see a labor force participation rate, which is a few percentage points above the general U.S. public.
Back in Woodburn, Oregon, Elizabeth Ramirez says she knows undocumented workers who have been deported and then returned. Ramirez, who's married and lives in town, helps out in her mother's store.
When Trump's like, oh, on the count of three, you're going to be gone. Now that people have gone and come back, they're like, well, it cost me quite a bit to come back, but I'm back, so they know how to work around it.
And it does cost, right?
A couple, 10 grand, a little more, depending on who's helping you.
a price that's clearly still worth it for some undocumented workers who assume they'll return to find work again in the booming U.S. economy. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
As Mitchell was saying, the undocumented labor force in this economy is really economically significant, but also not often heard from. Author and illustrator Duncan Tomatillo, himself a dual Mexican and American citizen who grew up on both sides of the border, is trying to tell the story of some of those people in a picture book, one meant more for grown-ups, though, not for kids. It's called Undocumented. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Give me the, I guess if this was a conventional book, I'd say give me the jacket blurb on this thing, but give me the very quick story on this thing, would you?
Well, it's an illustrated book that tells the story of an indigenous man from his village in Mexico coming to the U.S. without documents and working as a busboy, but then realizing that he's being exploited and taken advantage of and deciding to organize the people at his restaurant and his community to try and get better working conditions at his job.
The art is super cool, and the format is really cool as well. It's one of those with a hardcover on both ends, and then you can unfold it like almost like a giant map, but it tells the story in sequence on a series of panels.
Well, it's a project that began for me when I was in college, and at the time I volunteered at this worker center called NMAS, the National Mobilization Against Sweatshops, and there I met a person who inspired this story, this man who's Mixtec. And Mixtec is an indigenous community from the south of Mexico. Hmm. And that's why the book folds out like the artwork that the Mixtecs used to make hundreds of years ago. Undocumented immigrants are often in the news, but we don't hear so much about the exploitation and how poorly they are paid. And I thought it was important to talk about that aspect of it.
Well, yeah, it's the idea that what's happening on the border now is getting all the press, but there is an undocumented workforce inside this country already that plays a role in this economy.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think sometimes people are quick to talk about, you know, people breaking in and coming in without documents. But at the same time, I think people are happy to hire someone and pay them less than what they should because they don't have the proper documents, whether that is in, you know, in farming and construction, as a nanny, as a landscaper. There's millions of people working and being paid less than what they should or not having access to sick days or to overtime or to all other sorts of things that we take for granted.
I wonder if it's easier to address some of these tough issues, right, on a lot of levels, in the graphic format, right, because you can make it more relatable?
I think so. You know, I really wanted it to, you know, I think, you know, sometimes when we talk about immigration and the undocumented, it's in very abstract terms. You know, it's all about the economy. It's all about numbers and statistics. And I think we don't often hear the voices of people that are actually just trying to make a living. And, you know, me being a dual citizen, it's very easy for me to enter and exit the U.S., but I just thought it was important for someone to try and share some of those stories.
Undocumented is the latest graphic work from Duncan Tonatiuh. He has until now been a children's book author, but this is very much in the adult category. Duncan, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up.
Some people will see this as the kids' table, as, you know, some sort of lesser category.
Much like movies themselves, gang, the Academy Awards are a business. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street basically treaded a whole lot of water today. Dow Industrials down nearly 0.3%, 74 points, 25,509 for the blue chips. S&P 500 dipped 0.1%, 4 points, 28.53. The Nasdaq basically flat, 78.91. As we mentioned, this was not a good day for merger. Shares of Rite Aid coughed up a decline of 11.5% after it called off that merger with privately held Albertsons. Investors, however, seem to think Tribune Media and Sinclair Broadcasting are going to be just fine by themselves. Shares in both companies rose more than 2.5% today after that merger fell apart. Intrigue around Tesla continues to swirl. was the funding to go private secured or not? As I said, Tesla shares crashed about 4.8%. On Twitter, the social media giant was among the bright spots for traders today. Shares up 0.3%. Amazon stock delivered an increase of about 0.2%. More on that later in the broadcast. You're just going to have to stick around. Tech elsewhere, Microsoft, a bump of 0.1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We're going to do a story now about rising costs in two key slices of this economy and where they come together, higher education and housing. Tuition at California's four-year public universities has more than tripled in the past 20 years. But actual tuition is only part of the cost, of course. There's food and transportation and a place to live. And as rents in California have shot up, financial aid for that and other non-tuition costs has not matched. Vanessa Roncagno from KQED in San Francisco has that story.
When Sadia Khan got into California's top public university, it felt like fate. She'd wanted to go to UC Berkeley since middle school.
When the letter came, it was kind of like, I knew it.
She just didn't know how she was going to afford it. Like more than half of UC students, Khan wouldn't have to pay tuition because of her family's income. But she still had to figure out how to pay for a place to live.
Oh my God, looking for housing was, I don't even know how to put it. Like, it was just kind of like, okay, I'm definitely not going to school at this rate.
The average rent for a one-bedroom apartment in Berkeley is over $2,000. Khan was able to find something for $615 a month, but it was in a house with seven other people. She had to share a bedroom with two of them. Giving up privacy was hard. Even after a couple months, she still changed in the bathroom. But that was a small sacrifice compared to what else she'd left behind in her hometown 400 miles away.
Hasham! Hi, baby!
Khan's three-year-old son, Hasham, was back home with his grandmother. Khan FaceTimed him every day.
He gets, like, the smug little smile. And he'll... Mommy. Yeah, Bebo?
Sticky, dirty.
Khan got on a wait list for family student housing, and she was working to get additional financial aid. In the meantime, she took out loans. She signed up for food stamps and used the food pantry on campus. Surveys have found a growing number of students at public universities in California struggle with food and housing insecurity. Lupita Cortez Alcala, who oversees the state's financial aid programs, says limited financial aid for non-tuition costs is a big part of the problem.
What we don't do a great job of is really funding the cost of attendance, the total cost of attendance, which means the housing, the food, the transportation.
In a little over a decade, the median rent in California has gone up 44%. Over the same period, the maximum aid the state gives students for non-tuition costs has gone up by only 8%. At the federal level, Pell Grants for low-income students used to cover up to 80% of what it costs to go to an in-state public school. Now, the grants cover 30% at most.
We are holding students back from getting to college, getting through college, certainly getting through college in a timely way. And we're loading students, and particularly low-income students, up with student loan debt.
Debbie Cochran is the vice president of the Institute for College Access and Success. She says increasing funding for food and housing is part of the solution. So is building more affordable housing. 4 months into her first semester, things change for Sadia Khan. A spot opened up in UC Berkeley's family student housing. It's more expensive, but she's been able to get extra financial aid. Her son moved in with her, and her mom moved up to help take care of him.
We're able to, you know, go back to a lot of the things that we used to do, like, you know, waking up and brushing our teeth together, you know, making breakfast, going out to play.
the extra financial aid still doesn't cover all her expenses, so she's planning to get a part-time job. So far, she's taken out about $9,000 in student loans. She hopes someday this all pays off. In Berkeley, I'm Vanessa Rancagno for Marketplace.
I don't follow Rob Lowe on Twitter, but if I did, I wouldn't have missed this one yesterday. The film business passed away today, the actor said, with the announcement of the popular film Oscar. It's been in poor health for a number of years. It has survived by sequels, tentpoles, and vertical integration. He was talking, of course, about the big changes coming to the Oscars this year, including something called the popular film category. Tatiana Siegel is the deputy film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. We called her up to talk awards and the business thereof. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me back.
So are you with Rob Lowe that this is generally a mistake? What are you hearing?
Well, what I'm hearing is that most people do not think this is a great idea. Most people that I talked to yesterday, largely Academy members and other people who are affected by the decision, think that it was unnecessary because, you know, a great film that is popular, whatever that means, by the way, would have a chance to vie for the best picture, the top prize at the Academy Awards. So why have this special category?
Well, so let's be clear here. They're doing it because money, because it's a business, and because, as we now know, ABC has been driving this thing, right, to get the television show, better ratings.
Absolutely. The telecast has been on a downward trajectory for years, and last year was the least viewed Oscars of all time. So they had to do something. And ironically, Disney, which owns ABC and, you know, Marvel and Lucasfilm, will sort of benefit the most because it would be their tent poles, like a Star Wars film or a Black Panther that would wind up likely getting into this category of best popular film of the year.
Talk to me for a minute about the brand valuation here, because the Academy Awards now becomes a glitzier People's Choice Awards.
Exactly. The Academy Awards is supposed to be special. It's supposed to be, you know, the exclusive club of excellence in film. A movie that's made, you know, $1 billion already kind of won its prize by winning $1 billion, or by making $1 billion. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, to have this category is just sort of like everyone sees it for what it is, which is an overt attempt to draw in more viewers who have been shying away because maybe the films that have won in the last few years weren't as well known as, say, you know, Jurassic World or whatever the latest Marvel movie is.
Yeah, totally.
Yes.
So let me give you a what if here. Let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say Wonder Woman a couple of years ago, right? Incredibly popular film, did really well, but also I thought, this is just me, I thought it was a pretty good movie. What if it gets nominated or put into the most popular film category and the studio says, no thanks, we don't want that. We want to be in the actual best picture category.
Right. I mean, and that will definitely come into play because some people will see this as the kids' table, as, some sort of lesser category. And, well, why aren't we in the best picture race? But we don't even know what this category will be defined as. Will it be movies that have made $500 million or more at the box office worldwide? Or will it be, you know, an Adam Sandler comedy on Netflix? That could be, you know, construed as popular by some segment of the population.
Right. And it goes to the people's choicization of this thing that we talked about earlier, right? So instead of becoming more selective, the Academy has decided to broaden itself out and just go with the flow.
Yes, excellent point. It's kind of like, well, we'll try this because, you know, we no longer seem to be the special club, right. So maybe we'll go for mass appeal.
Tatiana Siegel, she's deputy film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Tatiana, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, here's your follow-up on Amazon, as promised earlier. The hat tip on this one goes to Carl Quintanilla of CNBC. Those of you waiting for the second trillion-dollar company in this economy, here with your most likely candidate. Amazon closed at $1,898 a share today. The trillion-dollar number for them is $2,050 a share. That's about 8% above where they are right now. Insert standard caveat here. My instructions say the stock market is not the economy, and the economy, of course, is not the stock market. All right, we're going. Dow Industrials down nearly 0.3% today, 74 points. S&P 500 lost about 0.1%, 4 points. NASDAQ basically flat. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.